think you all recognize, but in case you're not really clear on this, we're very, very fortunate to have Ron at the helm at the university. So thank you so much. It's an honor, actually, to share the tour. It makes me sound like a rock star. You know, anyway, thank you, because truly one of the things that I can say about Ron and Mary that I think people should know, because if you're on campus, it might not be clear. I'm not sure the literature talks about it. But it is very clear to those of us who are on campus all the time that they have a true affection, in fact, for the institution and for the students and the faculty and staff. And it's a very special thing, and it makes us all feel like we're really in a great place. So thank you, Ron. I'm going to hold my notes because, as an historian, I have some quotes, right, that I'm going to need to read to you. So I'll be carrying these around, but don't let them distract you. And I've got some pictures, and this tells me when I'm supposed to give you pictures. So I apologize in advance for carrying this stuff around, but it will be useful. So I'm going to be talking to you about the flu tonight, and I know that seems strange. Even those of you who studied with me, unless you suffered through my history methods class, wouldn't know that I have this connection to the history of influenza, and as a result have been studying it for several years. And let me explain just quickly how I came to be studying the influenza pandemic of 1918. In our history methods class, I keep looking at poor Mike Reed because, and Colleen, no, you didn't take it from me, did you?
Yes, I did.
Oh, you did? You wrote that good paper on Wilson. She's finished her PhD. She's about to finish her PhD at Cornell in history. So, anyway.
All thanks to this one.
In my history methods class, I try to explain that even though we're very systematic and we have plans and we talk a lot about how to do a history project, that in fact a lot of things happen just sort of inadvertently. That sometimes you just have that perfect, fortuitous, in this case, conversation that gets you started on something. And that's how I came to the flu. In 1995, I put this picture up because this is actually where this fortuitous conversation happened, but also for those of you who haven't been back west for a while, don't forget, it's really pretty there. Anyway, in 1995, I was on a hiking trip with my father and my future husband, and we were chatting, and I was about to come up for tenure, which meant I needed to both justify my past research, which I'd done, but I need to have a future project. I didn't have any idea what I was going to do. And I had a file to turn in. So we're sort of just chatting around, not about that at all, in fact. But we get to talk about my grandfather, and I knew he'd been orphaned, but it wasn't until one day by the side of the trail near Mount Hood on the Benson Plateau when it suddenly became clear to me that my grandfather had been orphaned in the influenza epidemic. He was, in fact, a part of this much bigger historical event, about which I knew almost nothing, but about which I'd also been really curious for many, many years. The story's a fairly simple one. I told you I'd be wandering. Okay, so this is my grandfather. The family story is a fairly simple one in terms of what we know. John Bristow was born maybe around 1905, and he had two parents who were from Ireland, and they died in the influenza pandemic. The story was that Elizabeth and John, the parents, had died within about a week of each other. They were from Ireland, and John was left an orphan. An orphan, in fact, with a younger brother named William. And that's essentially about as much as we know about what happened. I guess we know that Elizabeth had some family living nearby, and we knew that John Sr. moved houses for a living, and that's about as much of the story of the Bristow family that we have. I'll get to this in a second. Family lore really doesn't give me anything more than that, and in fact, it's interesting. This is about as far back as our history goes. When I asked my brother Jim whether he could tell me anything about our great-grandparents, he said, in fact, this: I know nothing of them. My history, he says, starts with their dying of the flu epidemic in 1918. It was a desire to reconstruct what happened then to the Bristows, to my grandfather, in this worldwide story. And I'll tell you a bit about the worldwide story in a minute. But to understand really what happened to my grandfather, and there was no way to access that because he's gone, all the relatives who could tell me anything about their story are gone to us. There's no way to get back to them. So the only way to do it was to build the world around them, in a sense, and to do a social and cultural history of the pandemic, in a sense to recreate the world in which John and William Elizabeth and John were living when this catastrophe hit them. And so for many, many years, for more years perhaps than I should, I've been studying this social and cultural history of the epidemic. And very quickly, my interest reached well beyond my grandfather, because in fact it's an amazing story of catastrophe and of survival, of trauma. tragedy, but also perhaps for some of hope. And I got very interested in sort of social and cultural questions. In other words, how did Americans understand what was happening to them? What was it like to be orphaned in the flu? But also, what was it like, say, to be a nurse and to actually be called upon to serve in this really important role and to actually be very useful, even as doctors found themselves entirely unsuccessful? What was it like to be African American in the context of a segregated health system? All these kinds of questions became passionately interesting to me, and it's a good thing. Because about 3 weeks ago, Truth in Advertising was acquired in China. Turns out, this is a census from 1920. I was looking around on Ancestry.com. If you want to find like death records and stuff, it's really great. It costs about $30 per month. So I'm playing around, seeing if I can find their death records. Because now that everything's digitized, I thought, sure, I can finally get John and Elizabeth's death records. No, what I get is actually John and Elizabeth, as well as John and William, and they're still alive. 1920 census. Do you see the problem with the picture? They're supposed to die in 1918. sort of funny thing happened on the way to the story. They apparently didn't die. They're still alive in 1920. I don't know, but, so I don't know what to do with that, and it's kind of a bummer because, as I told a few people, let me explain why it's a bummer. It's tragic in any case, and they did, in fact, I believe, die of influenza probably in 1920. So the tragedy of their life and the tragedy of what happened to my grandfather actually doesn't change at all. The thing that made me sad was that I'd written some really great stuff about this, and it's some of my best writing, and now I've got to talk about it. The good news is that, in fact, it doesn't make any less interesting, it seems to me, the story I want to tell you tonight. In fact, perhaps maybe it helps me. It helps facilitate my ability to talk about this as something much more than my family story, but really as a worldwide story. But I especially want to talk about the national story. The historians weren't very interested in this for a long time, interestingly enough. Alfred Crosby really wrote the first book that Americans were interested by in 1976. It was re-released in 1989. I noticed, or I put this up on the screen for you, because his title is really informative to us. He noticed that no one was writing about it, and in fact, he noticed that persisted even after his book. So 13 years later, when it was re-released, he changed the title. It was originally called Epidemic and Peace. He changed it to America's Forgotten Pandemic to draw attention on the very cover of his book to the fact that Americans forgot about it. Historians didn't write about it, but neither did anyone else. And so he and other historians subsequently have talked a lot about the cultural amnesia that seems to surround this thing. And that's part of what I'm really interested in. So what I want to talk about tonight, that's a long introduction, I promise I won't go on forever. I want to talk about specifically a couple of things. I want to give you some basics on the epidemic so you can understand that this really was a big deal. It's odd that it is our forgotten pandemic. Then second, I want to talk a little bit about how it was remembered, but also how it came to be forgotten. And in fact, argue that it hasn't been entirely forgotten, but on a private level, it's very much still even. Though for very few people today, because of the passage of time, that it is still a private memory, without doubt. And then say a few things at the end about why I think this matters. In fact, I think this project has tremendous relevance, and it's not because we're worrying about H5N1 over in East Asia. It's actually, I think, this particular story I'm going to tell you tonight is also relevant. It has something to tell us about cultural amnesia and the problem of some of the things that I think we forget. So let me tell you a little bit about the epidemic. When it first broke, it was immediately clear that this was a terrible, terrible thing, and people had a very hard time talking about it. In fact, they would say over and over again that it really stretched the imagination, that there were no words for how terrible it was. A letter writer in 1918 said, "You have no idea what havoc this influenza has wrought everywhere." At the most elemental level, it was about suffering. It was about people being sick, about people dying, about people trying to take care of one another, even as they feared terribly themselves catching this disease, which was extraordinarily infectious. Patients who were stricken, the families that tried to care for them, and the communities that were the context for that are really at the center of the work that I do. Entire families were sometimes stricken. The stories that you read, and I could go on and on, but I'll try to give you a less appalling version. So I won't put up any pictures of what people actually looked like or give you any too many details. But I would say that you need to recognize that this was a situation in which you could have a family where both parents would die and no one would know it because things were in such chaos. chaos. Children, young children might be left alone in the house. They had dead parents for several days. Even when they did know that the parents had died, there were often insufficient. There was no one available to remove bodies. There was nobody available to dig graves. There was no one. There were not enough coffins in the major cities around the East Coast, in particular, where they didn't have the ready access to lumber. It was a situation in which people were made even more anxious because we were at war. So families were separated. This is a picture of a ward at Camp Funston. The military was a big part of the problem because we were moving hundreds of thousands of people all over the world. It probably actually had its origins near Camp Funston, went to Europe in the late spring and summer, and then came back to the United States in late August, September, when it breaks out again. The war makes it harder because people don't know what's happening to one another. This is before everybody's got a cell phone. So all you can do is worry until the next letter comes. Even the best urban administrations were completely overwhelmed by the epidemic. This is a scene of one of the wards they set up in Boston just outside. Remember, this is in the autumn, so it might have been nice out, but it didn't have to be. This particular day, there's no rain coming down, and yet this is a really frightening thing for these urban administrations have to deal with. Places like Philadelphia in particular, it took Philadelphia a really long time to get a grip on what was happening to them. And they were really in chaos for up to a month, I would say. So it was really a terrible time. And public health was doing its best, but it wasn't an easy time to keep up with what was happening. Part of what makes this such an awful thing isn't just, there are many things. I won't say there isn't any one that it isn't. What it is very, very surprising for people in a lot of ways. Flu's not supposed to kill you. Well, it's supposed to kill a few people every year, and it still does, by the way, right? Thousands of people every year. But most of us don't know very many people who passed from the flu, and if they do, it's usually an older person, an elderly person, or a very young child, frequently an infant. This influenza is different, okay? It's going to be different in a whole bunch of ways, and that will make it very hard on people. The first wave that comes through, in fact, comes in the spring, and nobody notices, because influenza always comes through and always have a few people who die and a lot of people who get sick in the winter, right? We're all kind of hoping not to be the one that gets sick this year, right? It's just something that comes and goes. So people didn't even notice it when it came through, or didn't notice it as about to be a cataclysmic event. But fairly quickly, when it comes in its second wave in the fall, people discover very quickly. You can see how fast it spreads as it gets lighter and lighter. That's the passage of weeks, and you can see how quickly it actually moves across the country with this first week. In fact, there are pockets of it turning up all the way in California. So it expands very, very quickly, and that frightens people. It moves with a pace that no one could have expected, so that within a few weeks, literally from Baltimore to Birmingham, from Pittsburgh to Portland, you've got influenza. It just hits fast and it hits hard. In turn, the disease itself is an appalling one. And here again, I won't give you too many details because I don't want to disgust you, but you do need to understand why this would have scared people so badly. Okay, flu is already bad, right? You don't feel very good. You get aches and pains, a headache, a fever, that kind of stuff, right? So this starts that way sometimes, but sometimes within 12 hours, people are dead, right? For those people, the symptoms would move from those traditional flu symptoms, and this is for about 4/5 of people who get a worse version of the flu. They would eventually begin to suffer from terrible, terrible pain in their joints. These are life-ending pain. But eventually the problem is the immune system responds, and they begin, the lungs begin to create these fluids in which they eventually drown. So their faces turn blue, sometimes really a dark purple, sometimes literally black, and eventually they will bleed, often from their noses and other. So it was really an awful one to see, right? People would get delirious before they became unconscious. It's very hard for the people who had to suffer through this with them. It was just, simply put, a really frightening disease. Sometimes it only took 12 hours, other times it could take 3, 4 days, 10 days, 2 weeks. If you didn't die of the flu, you might die of pneumonia, you might die of a bacterial infection. Now, streptococcus seems to be of some note here, according to recent press. So, again, it surprises them because it comes fast, it surprises them because it's horrifying. It looks bad, the experience of it is really frightening. Even doctors and nurses who are used to being around sick people, these are often nurses and doctors who've worked with the military, even they were sort of shocked and appalled and sort of recoiled in the things that they write about it. For instance, three doctors recalling how hopeless it felt said, "The memory of the sight will haunt for life the minds of those who saw it." So here are hardened physicians and nurses who would just say, "This is like the worst thing I've ever seen." It's a cheery talk so far. Okay. It's also an awful thing and very surprising because of who it's killing. Traditionally with influenza, you would have a U diagram here because the people that die from influenza are usually the very young and the elderly. Here you'll notice instead we have a W. That's a bad sign because who's that that's killing then are these young adults. Okay, so it's killing, again, it's not killing the right people. It's throwing people off. This chart's just sort of fun. This is what life expectancy does between 1900 and 1960. This is 1918. So you can see how severe this is because it's killing the wrong people. It throws all the life expectancy chart off completely for that 1 year. So what's happening then are young adults are dying. Now again, at war, 50-some thousand Americans are going to die in World War I. Who's dying? Young men. Right, so worldwide you have young men dying in the war, and then you have literally millions of people dying. In the United States, they figure about 500 to 550,000 excess deaths. In other words, in addition to the ones that would usually die of flu. Worldwide, we don't know because it wasn't a reportable disease, and there was no public health system at all in many countries at that point. But the historians today are estimating no less than 50 million, and maybe as high as 100 million. So I mean, we're talking about truly a worldwide catastrophe. Again, something that people hadn't expected. The rate of infection, the rate of death is also really surprising. Probably close to a quarter, maybe a little bit more than a quarter of Americans actually are infected at some point during the epidemic. 2.5% of those will die, which is many times the normal rate of death with influenza. It's also a surprise because this just isn't supposed to be happening. It's the early 20th century, right? We're progressing. We've got science now, right? Physicians, they're curing things, they're preventing things. It's a wonderful time in American science. So no one expects, even when it first starts to happen, people write about how it's all going to be okay because like the doctors are going to figure this out. The day you mentioned I went to Cal, so this is from the Daily Californian, the school paper actually has a story about this, and they say in an editorial to the students, "There seems to be no occasion for special alarm or panic about the matter, for the disease is evidently one which the American medical profession is perfectly able to handle." Needless to say, that story was told over and over and over again in New York. In fact, don't get me started, New York really screws up. New York's public health commissioner was a political appointee. He was a complete political hack. He had no idea what he was doing. New York is partly responsible for why it happened so hard and so fast on the East Coast. Again and again and again and again, he tells the New York Times, "Don't worry, it's all going to be fine. Really, don't worry. We've got this under control." The problem, of course, is even when they tried to, they didn't. Now again, that's not to suggest that people didn't try very, very hard. And the nurses, the doctors, the public health people are really quite remarkable during this. So many of them put their lives on the line, in fact. And many doctors, nurses, and public health people, of course, will die of the flu because they are spending time with the patients. At the federal, state, and local levels, there's a lot of effort to try to contain this thing. The disappointment is that they're really unable to. It's possible that some of the measures they use help a little bit. It's very hard to tell. But the bottom line is they can't do much except nurse them. In fact, in some ways, the nurses are the real heroines because they're the ones who can actually provide that kind of care. That's what they were responsible for, and they're very successful at doing that. They'll try a number of different things over the course of the epidemic to try to keep people from getting sick. They'll ask people, in fact, to wear a mask. Here they're encouraging people to make a mask. Here they're talking about going home the minute you're sick. This is a long list of, here they actually will then begin to close things because they figure, well, the masking isn't working, so we don't want people to get together too much, so they'll close schools. Increasingly stringent things to try to contain the flu. Again, it's possible, actually, that the public closures worked some. But they do them too late in most places. And then immediately in November, right, they're having a Liberty Loan Drive, they're fundraising, and nobody can bear not to hold the parades or the public gatherings. And so again, second week in November, right before the war ends, literally like 2 days before, all these Liberty Loan get-togethers, and of course, it sets it off again. So anyway, they're not very successful. What this means, and again, just trying to show you, this was a big deal. it just means that life was really, really altered in ways that were really visual, in ways that could not be missed by anyone. There was simply no way to avoid it altogether. For many, many Americans, it seemed that the world had simply been turned upside down. As one correspondent writes, the whole world seems upside down. So many people around here have died, and so many are sick. So was it forgotten? I mean, so historians say, it's this big deal, and nobody forgets about it. How many of you have been to a memorial, you know, like how we have war memorial stuff? How many have been to a memorial for a war? You know, any of the wars, or seen one of these. So, how many of you have been to a memorial for the influenza pandemic in which 500,000 Americans died? How many of you have read a novel that was written in both that early 20th century period that references or has it as a central theme? How many of you can think of a song that was written about? Now, there are actually some classic blues songs written about it, but how many of you have heard those? Okay, yeah, you're a PhD. Get out of here. Get out of here. How many of you have seen a movie like that puts it as a central theme or at least a backdrop? Right? Nobody. Right? It's not in the public discourse about that period. How many of you have studied it in a history class? Yay!
That's different. How many of us have had their grandparents talking about living?
Yeah, great. How did you know that I was going to ask that question? You're a little early, but how many?
Okay.
How many? Oh, really? Only that many? Oh, see, usually, because that's a good guess, usually it's a much higher number, which is part of my point. So it does seem to be forgotten then in this public cultural way. It's not part of the cultural, the public culture of the country, right? And in fact, that happened relatively quickly. And I want to suggest just briefly two reasons that I think that happened. It is initially remembered because, of course, it had just happened. So people are talking about it initially, but very quickly when they talk about it, they talk about it as part of the war. Now, forever, we've used war as a way to, or used military rhetoric to talk about disease, right? War on cancer, we're battling AIDS. We use that sort of martial rhetoric because it makes us feel strong, powerful, like we're doing something, right? And that's a very common rhetoric. It goes back probably thousands of years to use that kind of language to talk about dealing with the disease, and people do that in the epidemic. Of course, they talk about battling it. They talk about nurses are saviors in blue. Doctors are the first line of defense. Interestingly enough, some people even believe that it literally was part of the war. They thought Germany had caused it. Germany had intentionally shipped it over. This one sort of hints at that belief system, saying, this is Kaiser Wilhelm's ally, and here's what you got to do to not get it. Do your bit, which is actually language from the war effort, do your bit to stop the grip. So some people believe it was literally part of the war, but even for those who didn't believe it, they would reference it. So here, it's talking about that it's as dangerous, I'm sorry, this is so blurry, as dangerous as poison gas shells. Right? So during the war, during the epidemic, these two are conflated in the way people talk about it, and that persists after the war is over. Though many people would describe it in lots of different kinds of terms, it was like a storm, it was like a plague, it was like a wildfire, it was a nightmare, this is indescribable. The most common language used to write about it is this war metaphor. And so again and again and again, people would say that it was just like the Great War, only worse. It was a way actually to say how bad this flu was to compare it to what was at that point the Great War, right? So that metaphor worked especially well here, more I think than in some other cases, because we were at war and it was a sort of a cultural reference that made sense to people. It also was one that they seemed to use because it was a way to infuse these terrible losses with a kind of meaning. To die in war is to serve your country and be a martyr. To die in the epidemic is so pointless. And often in the memorials, especially for soldiers who died, but also often for doctors and nurses, people would use the language of the military hero to talk about the people who died. Governor Harding, in a really remarkable memorial for troops at Camp Dodge, says, "We assemble today in the presence of the immortal spirits of these soldiers who, clothed in the uniform of their country, were stricken on their way to the battle front. The voice of the dead in this mightiest of wars will be one utterance from all who gave their lives in the battle landing camp. The voice of these," meaning the people who died in the flu, "the voice of these will mingle in the mighty course of the martyr forces of the past." You just feel and wanting to infuse this with importance, with meaning, so it feels less pointless. The point is, by conflating the war and influenza fairly quickly, it becomes subsumed and eventually just sort of overshadowed and disappears. We still talk about the war all the time, but we don't still talk about the flu. The second reason I think, and it has to do with how we remember the flu, the second reason I think we've forgotten it also has to do with remembering it. It was very quickly recast, and this is almost bizarre to me, recast in what I think of as the sort of the traditional American narrative, which is we're progressive. We're always on our way to something better, right? We're always looking to that next hill. We're always looking at that next investment. I shouldn't say the next investment, but you know what I mean. The next good thing that's going to happen with our money. We really are people who think about the future. We're future-oriented. We believe that things are getting better. It's been the history. I mean, it's the story of the country in some ways. Even when we see problems with it, it's hard not to admit that it's a big part of the national story, right? In American culture, influenza very quickly becomes, or the epidemic, a tragedy, and yet, very quickly, we move from talking about the horror of it to talking about the opportunities that opened up, the things we learned from it, how much better we're getting. Very quickly, historians decide, the people of the time will begin to frame what we call a narrative around it, and I'll just tell you about this in a second. Historians talk about sort of the way that people talk about something. Is there a shared way that the country seems to talk about something? We'll call that a narrative. This historian, Edward Lilienthal, talks about the progressive narrative that Americans tend to use about things. Here he was writing about the Oklahoma City bombing, where he found very quickly people shift from talking about this awful terrorist attack to a new narrative in which it invites the city, he was looking at Oklahoma City, to focus on the possibility, the opportunity, the healing, the rebuilding that comes after the tragedy. This notion of a progressive narrative works just as well. It's clear, even during the epidemic, you can hear a little bit of it, but as soon as the epidemic begins to recede, very quickly the progressive narrative becomes central. Here's one example just to show you what I mean. The New York Times still does this, right? Does its 100 neediest cases. I think they call it something different now. But anyway, you guys know all about this. You take the New York Times, you probably can't avoid it. At wintertime, remember how they do that in December? They fundraise, and each day it's for a different thing, and you can send it into that exact thing, right? They still do it. I'm not making this up. Though historians have been known to do so. The 100 neediest cases of 1918, of course, includes a lot of people whose families are devastated by the flu. Look at how they talk about them mid-1919. These are from June. Since Christmas, three members of this family have had influenza. Okay, the epidemic didn't stop. But due to the care we've been able to give the family, they recovered. Right? Over here, the family self-supporting. The man recovered. He couldn't return to work right away, but look what we did. The man is in good... This is a happy and healthy family today. Right? Very quickly, we forgot about the tragedy in the public school. And yet the question from the back raises the exact point, which is on the private level, it persists. People don't forget about it. I've done interviews and I've read a lot of accounts of people, and it is clear that on the personal level, the private level, the family level, people do remember this. And what they remember is not a progressive narrative of everything being, you know, we lived happily ever after. In fact, frequently the stories are stories of tragedy. And they know those stories of tragedy. They are living those stories of tragedy. And I'll give you just one example to show you what I mean. This is a young man. Well, actually, let me, one other thing first, actually. One place I've seen this a lot so that I can sort of suggest there's a lot of this response. World War I veterans had the opportunity to fill out a questionnaire about their war experiences that were collected then at the Carlisle, the Military History Center at Carlisle Barracks in Pennsylvania. And it's an interesting place to go do research. And they filled out these questionnaires in the 1970s. So I'm talking about 50 years removed from the epidemic at least, right? Over and over and over, they say things like, flu was extremely bad, hundreds of our men died. Many never got over it. Boys died like flies. I can to this day see the cords of bodies stacked in the base hospital. They were dying faster than their bodies could be taken care of. People remember this happening. Here's one personal story. Melvin Frank recalled the horrors of the epidemic and what it cost his family. He says, by whatever name, the disease was a killer, and scarcely any household in our Northside neighborhood was unaffected. It brought eventual tragedy to our house. hear him talk about what happened. His father actually had cardiac asthma, which was made much worse with the epidemic, and he didn't die then until 1920, but he was very ill after that. He says, that spring he suffered from frequent smothering and choking spells that racked him with horrible coughing. It was a terrible thing for a boy to see his father struggle for breath. Eventually his father became a bed patient, and the entire family suffered with him. He was eventually hospitalized, and at this point the family became quite depressed. He says, gloom descended. A sob was close to the surface. His father died on June 24, 1920, and though the death came a long time after his exposure to influenza, it's clearly an influenza-related death. Frank says that he found himself reeling because, he says, my world had tumbled in. Like many other youths in that time, and like the story of my grandfather, and perhaps even in the same year, I don't know, he was told that he was now the man of the family, and at the age of 12, he quit going to school and assumed the role of primary breadwinner of his family. The toxicity could prove lasting as well. Melvin Frank had written this piece decades ago, but I did an interview in 2003 with a gal in Tacoma, and she talked about having lost her mother. Her father was not allowed to have the young daughters in the home, so she was shipped out to family members and says, you know, my life has changed forever. It has to have affected me. And though she tried to laugh and joke about it, it was clear that it had a profound impact on her. So why do we care? Maybe you don't, but I'm going to give you one last shot, okay? Here's what I'm thinking. What I'm trying to say is there's a difference between this public amnesia, the forgotten pandemic, and the home reality, the reality of people's hearts, the realities of people's actual lives, where this didn't just go away, where they continued to live with it. They lived with those losses, or they lived with the disability that was created by it. People suffered blindness, people suffered heart problems, all kinds of problems, not just the traditional notion of lung problems. This was a crazy disease. So people continued to suffer. What does that matter? Why do we care that some people continue to remember and a lot of people didn't? Why would it matter? I would argue it matters profoundly, because I believe that that disjunction between is very costly for those who are still remembering what I would call a toxic or a tragic narrative of this event. It's hard to know for sure. As I say, very few of the people who suffered through this are still with us, so I'm not able to test this. But historians have done a lot of work in recent years with the aftermath of trauma and catastrophe. And it seems to suggest that having that disjunction is very costly for survivors. They've looked at people who have suffered from sexual assault, people who suffered the aftermath of Oklahoma City bombing, for instance. And they find very clearly that there are costs to this. One cost is a tendency, because of the progressive narrative, to expect everybody to just get over it. Buck up! Right? Everybody else is moving on. Let's get some closure and move on. Why don't you just get better? Right? The problem, folks who study these things say, as one particular journalist, Errol Laborde, says, suggesting Oklahoma City and the bombing there in the aftermath, says the hard truth is that there's some wounds that will just never heal. Right? Only the toxic narrative, he says, deals with the reality of that chronic affliction. But that toxic narrative isn't shared. Now again, why does that matter? Why can't you just talk to your family at least? Apparently, again, this is, I can't know for certain, but they seem to suggest from studies that have been done with survivors of other kinds of trauma, that the silencing, that sort of unwillingness to go to that sadder story, to acknowledge that, in a sense, what should be a nationally shared tragedy, that unwillingness, in fact, is very hard on those who are suffering in this way. A woman, Susan Bryce, has written really a brilliant account of her own struggle in the wake of sexual assault. And she suggests that this trauma survivor must find empathetic listeners in order to carry on. And she says it's almost impossible to find that empathetic listener. She talks at length about the ways in which her friends hoped that she would just get better, that she should just, as she says, buff up. Now, again, I'm not trying to say that the flu epidemic and sexual assault and terrorist attacks are the same thing. They're obviously very different. And yet the aftermath of a trauma may have some things in common. And again, there seems to be evidence to suggest this. So what does that mean? Why do we care? Because I think that suggests a certain kind of responsibility. We can actually learn something from 1918 about the tragedies of these people. Tragedies that didn't just go away, but that were forgotten, that I think should inform how we approach some of the folks in our own lives and in our own 2009, we are in fact surrounded by people who have suffered through traumas, whether it is victims of violent crime, victims of Hurricane Katrina, victims of tornadoes in Oklahoma yesterday, people who have served in wars in Vietnam and Iraq and Afghanistan, who perhaps have suffered traumas there. Those people are all around us. I also think that our nation still really does have a tendency towards the progressive narrative. And that may be a good thing. It's good to have hope. It's good to look forward. But it might be useful to remember that not everyone always can. Perhaps to have a bit more willingness to complicate our own narratives about our present day. Perhaps as a service, I think, to those who have in fact. So, yes. Anybody have a question?
Yeah,
sir.
Okay. You did mention bullet holes in the sci-fi areas about the academic period. My grandfather lived in that period of time and ultimately suffered from Parkinson's syndrome.
Yeah.
And there was a very high correlation for survivors who managed to get through that terrible period of time.
That's right.
Who then died a terrible death.
And that it's funny, I was just reading about that on the plane yesterday, literally, because they don't know why. They don't understand it, but it's very
significant.
Yeah, there's no question it's statistically significant. And again, they don't understand why, but it's very clear that there's a connection. That's absolutely right. Perhaps with all the, because now they've actually cracked the whole gene, they've done the genome of the, they've got this all figured out, they may have the ability to figure it out. The other one is, what's that movie, the sort of sleeping sickness? Remember that movie? Oh, shoot, nobody's going to remember what I'm talking about. But it's this thing where you fall asleep and then they woke up for a little while and then they fell asleep again in the film.
Awaken?
Yeah!
Robin Williams?
Yeah! Yeah! So those people, they think it may be something connected to the flu, but they have no idea why. But again, that one is not as easy to track because it's a very small, statistically very small sample, whereas with Parkinson's, it's a very large sample. Yeah.
This is sort of a
oh, good Lord. That word is scary enough, but go ahead. Let's just remember I'm in the Department of, what was that? History, yeah.
I'm a biologist at that point.
Yeah, okay, I was afraid there'd be somebody in here that knew some science.
What happened to influenza? I mean, why did it go away?
Yeah, it burns itself out. It literally has infected everybody who it can, and when it runs out of victims, it ends. What it also continues to do is what's called drift and shift. And that's what's scary to us, because influenza is one of the best diseases out there in terms of its own ability to recreate itself. And so though that one's gone, right, we've got H5N1 right now in Asia and we're worrying about it, because right now humans can only get infected from an animal. If it can learn how to go from a human to a human, it will have some of the things like 1918. But influenza will eventually, as an epidemic, it will eventually infect everyone it can. And again, we're talking about 100 million people may have died. We're talking about a quarter of Americans having been infected. So, it had exposure to everyone. And then it dries out. It does come in three waves. So it will have shifted enough to come back and infect a few more people in the spring and summer of 1919, and then it does go, we think. Yeah.
You said you interviewed a woman in Tacoma.
Yeah.
I guess my question is, what was the breadth of on the west coast that were having this problem? Because on the east coast it was bad because there was problems with lumber and getting people buried.
It's a nationwide, it's a worldwide problem. Tahiti, Alaska, South Africa, India, China, everybody has it. And
right.
In the United States it's the same problem. It hits a little bit later, mostly on the west coast compared to the east. It takes a few weeks to make the full trip, but as you could see from that chart earlier, it actually does make it successful. This whole technology thing is so fancy. There you go. So you can see how it's not getting here until after October 5th, but it gets there. Right? It's pretty fast. It's a pretty incredible map, I think.
Is it called the Spanish flu?
Yes, it is called the Spanish flu, because that's a great question, Vaughn. Because I know the answer. And I didn't even plant them, honestly. It's World War I, and most of the governments in Europe are not talking about the fact that all their people are dying of flu, because they've got wartime censorship. Spain is not and does not have censorship and is willing to talk about all the people who are sick in Spain. So we call it the Spanish influenza. Where did it actually come from? Probably not us. Though again, there's arguments. It could be China. It could be France, but probably I'm still convinced it's the U.S. Just I haven't read anything yet that convinces me otherwise.
Yeah.
I have a question actually about that map.
Yeah, good luck.
Given the differences in transportation then as now, if there were an equivalent now, I guess the difference there is 3 weeks or something.
Yeah.
What would it look like now?
It wouldn't look like this. You're absolutely right. And that's what everybody's talking about. And that's when the public health people want to talk to you about this. This is what they're trying to tell you, right? People are on airplanes now. I mean, I'm right here now, and I'm going to be right here tomorrow morning. Well, tomorrow afternoon, right around noontime, right? So the chances are it would all be much faster. The advantage now, to be clear, so that I don't sound like somebody's just here to frighten you all, though get your flu shots if you didn't yet. antibiotics will help with a lot of things people died from. A lot of people died from bacterial pneumonia. They seem there was just a story that a lot of people, maybe streptococcus, a lot of people still died of the flu, but some people died of infections that we could prevent now. But the reality is it will travel even faster. And this one was crazy. Within a week, it exploded in Sierra Leone, the United States, and France. Literally, like within faster than people could get between those places. So it's just horrifying and scary. You had
influenza? Has PBS done a show?
Yeah, there is a show. In fact, it's called like Influenza 1918 or something like that, and it's terrific. Okay. If you want to see what this looked like, it's very good at that. And there's a nice short book called Influenza 1918 that's sort of a TV show put into a little book. It's got some nice oral history stuff and some good photographs. And it's part of the American Experience series, so you can actually, I guess you have to buy it, but it's very cheap. Really interesting.
Was it proportionally worse in cities than it was in rural areas?
Isn't it crazy? That's one of the things that, again, nothing can protect you. People were moving from the country to the city thinking it'd be better to be there because there were doctors there, and people were moving from the cities to the country because they figured it'd be better to be in the fresh air. There are villages up in the upper reaches of the Arctic where the whole village is simply wiped out. So there was nowhere, and there's like one city, and I still don't remember where it was. There's one city that escapes it, and I can't remember where it is. Excellent guess. I feel like it is in the Northwest, but they won't let anyone in. And there's that novel now that sort of tries to tell that story, what's called The Last Town on Earth. Anybody read that? Oh, maybe I only get it like presents like that because I study the flu. My Christmas stocking last year, my brother was so pleased with himself. But anyway, it's actually an interesting story. It was a much better novel than I expected it to be. It handles it in a very interesting way. But no, it wasn't. There was nowhere to be. And again, we don't really understand how it got. How did it get from place to place when nobody was traveling? Sometimes is really unclear. It's just it's a remarkable thing. Horrifying.
Okay, so I'm a medievalist, and I study the plague, and I'm kind of curious because one of the things I talk about with my students is the interesting way that people deal with disease, so the reaction to it and the way that people cope in thinking about cures, like how do we deal with it? So in medieval period, you end up with some very odd things, like claying town bells, right, because you scare away enemies by claying your town bell, so, right, disease is an enemy, we'll claim the town bell, maybe it'll go away. But what you're just talking about is closing borders, and there's a lot of quarantine. So I'm kind of curious as to what the local populations were doing to grapple with the disease. So you have sort of the health experts who are saying, oh, we're fine, and then they have their institutional reactions to it. But what are sort of the local reactions to it? What are the people doing? What are their sort of remedies or approaches to this disease?
You name it, they got it. Everything from you got to drink whiskey to don't drink any whiskey. Hang garlic cloves around your neck.
Camphor balls.
What's that? Camphor balls. Camphor was way in, absolutely. Yeah. All of those sort of, the quack stuff, what do you call them, patent medicines, right? Okay. All of patent, it's really fun to track this, actually. It's a great book on the history of patent medicines, and he notes that, within the, first 2 weeks of the epidemic, there's all these treatments that used to be to cure stomach trouble or to help with, bad pregnancies that are suddenly, going to solve the flu problem. And again, there's advertisements for these in every newspaper in the country. But everything you can think of, from poems to read, there were voodoo treatments for it, everything. But initially, it's really interesting to track that, because I get the impression that initially people, they do believe that science is going to help. And it's not, I think that those things probably pick up speed as it becomes clear that there's not much that can be done. And the doctors who are responsible are very open about that and say, listen, the best thing you can do is go home and take good care of yourself. We can't help you. I don't have a shot for this. I don't have, but no, they do all kinds of crazy things. It's, and that's some of the funnest stuff to read about.
I just have a question about the idea of the progressive narrative and why this falls into the progressive narrative when other things fall out of the progressive narrative. So an example like AIDS, where it doesn't seem like it's falling into that, but in many ways it's very similar. And sort of, so what causes our nation to react to something in that manner?
That's a great question. It's a really good question, and I do not have a ready answer for that. One thing I would say about AIDS that I think has helped keep it in the more tragic narrative is a population that has worked very hard to make that happen. It's also something that hasn't gone away, so it's still with us, even though people, right, with the cocktail, we don't do much better, but it's still with us. So that's probably part of it. But I think this issue of when does it kick in and when doesn't it kick in is a really interesting question, because it does seem like kind of the dominant story of sort of how the United States thinks about things, right? You can even go to the Great Depression, and very quickly you've got FDR saying, you know, the only thing we have to fear is fear itself, really trying to say, you know, all we have to do is think more positively and everything's going to be okay, and, you know, life is but a bowl of cherries, and all these songs start coming out, right? We're really trying to put that positive in even on that. So it's a great question. Do you have an idea?
I have
an idea, please go.
To have people who are writing or documenting it or are articulating it in the moment. So even the Great Depression, you have examples like Steinbeck writing Great Breath at the time. So you have a more nuanced picture of it than maybe the influence of art does. So that we have this sort of like epic historical artifact that help to articulate it in the moment itself and with it, you know, people who are like writing and talking about it at the time.
It's really interesting how little it turns up, because we think of the lost generation of the 20s, right, writing all that great literature, and they don't write about the flu. There's like a couple words about it in Willa Cather's One of Ours, but that's her worst novel, so nobody reads it. Catherine Ann Porter wrote a great novella called Pale Horse, Pale Rider, and it is a brilliant treatment. It was brilliant when she wrote it, and it's brilliant today, but that's about it. Thomas Wolfe's Look Homeward, Angel also has the main character has a family relative who has to go. He goes home from college to be there for this death, and he just has this graphic detail in what's happening to this really dysfunctional family. That's about it. You're absolutely right, and I think that's part of it. There are a couple of really good blues songs. Who wrote them was argued about, but literally, I have this friend who we call ourselves flustorians. He's a flustorian too, and he's tracked down all of the. He sort of loves the whole idea of disease and music, and he could literally only come up with three or four songs. So I mean, there's just not much out there. And I think you're right that that's a part of it. But why isn't there? Because people were writing. There's great stuff happening. There's amazing moment in music and in literature, and yet. Doesn't get picked up. And yet, how many novels did those guys write about World War I? Thank you. Anybody else have to read a lot of Hemingway at some point? Right? You know what I'm saying, though? World War I is very much in the public conversation. And yet,
the war is more glamorous than disease.
I suppose.
Plus, it's also more protracted. I mean, here you're talking about a three-week spread.
Well, although it does, it ends up lasting several months. But you're absolutely right. What's interesting, though, is 10 times as many Americans die from flu as from the war. And the war, we're really only militarily involved for a fairly short time because it takes us so long to get the troops there.
It's more glamorous.
But it's definitely more glamorous. There's a way to talk about it that's more meaningful. And it has that sense of a lasting impact because it's this brutal thing.
Right.
It's also a martyrdom issue. I mean, the thing that you were talking about with it's more glorious to die in war than it is from disease that has no meaning. And so to write the Hemingway novel in which you die either a glorious or quite inglorious death based on how you perceive the war is a much better novel to write than you die from disease, you die from the flu.
And yet Catherine Ann Porter is all over it, seriously. If you're at all interested in this and you wanted something to pick up to read, her novella is really lovely. It's a very sad book, but it's very, very... It picks up both the mood of the war and the mood of the epidemic in ways that I think no one
just a very quick question. Yeah. In 1918, in your Glenapoix expedition, where it was, is there discussion at all of the probability of anything of such magnitude current? I mean,
yes.
With technology and medicine, is this could not happen? Or are you saying that
it absolutely could? It absolutely could, and people are. So when the government starts talking about wanting to do some things with flu research or wanting us to be prepared for something, that's a good idea. It's very serious business. There is, in fact, I won't go into the details because I get them wrong anyway, but the way that the flu virus works, there are different ones, and they can track which kind, which category. There's A, B, and C, and then within that there's an H and an N number. And the H5N1 has traditionally been a very disastrous influenza, and that's the one that we're having trouble with the fowl, with the birds in Asia right now. Remember the last couple of years, people be getting this and then they die? If that can learn to go from, right, and yet it's still going, and if it can learn to go, as I said before, right now it's only going animal to human. But influenza is very good at learning. If it can learn, if it can manage to get, what happens is, if a pig can get, if the pig can catch the bird one and the human one, it can rearrange itself and become capable of going person to person. If it goes person to person, we're in serious trouble. Now, again, I'm not trying to tell you frighten. But I don't mean to frighten you, but in fact, if they start saying that we're really in trouble with this, pay attention to them, because the public health people have important things to tell us about.
The two ways we responded, I think 2.5 years ago, when there was that influx of shortage flu shots and how it reacted universally. And then here in New York specifically, we had anthrax scare.
Right.
You know, post 9/11,
right.
It was.
Right.
There's a learning curve there as to.
Right. No, that's right. And it's hard because the government had cried wolf with a couple of other expected epidemics back in the 50s and 60s. And so there was a generation that just was never going to move to any of this. And I think we're back in this place where we just don't expect flu to cause a lot of trouble. We're worrying about anthrax.
We had so much of a shortage. And then everybody was trying. And then the following year, it was like we had an overage. And then I'll ask, then why was there a shortage?
Well, I can that's a very simple, this will be the last thing I say, I promise, Dave. But with the flu vaccine, what they're actually doing is trying to guess which flus are going to be serious problems in the coming year. So a group of scientists sit down and figure this out at the CDC down in Atlanta. And they pick the 3 or 4 strains, that's as many, I think it's like 3 or 4 or 5 is the maximum that they can do in a shot.
Mm-hmm.
And they have to guess. And they can't make that ahead of time because by the next year, the ones that are going to be a risk hadn't even existed yet a year ago, right? So they're doing the best they can. So if there's too many or too few, again, it's not the CDC's fault and it's not the public health people's fault. They're doing the best they can with something that's really, really complicated to do. Okay.
Blame the virus.
Blame the virus. He's really a good one.
Well, no, you think about it every year.
No. No, I don't. David, get to that.
Nancy, first up. Thank you.